Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I will tell you that we arrested. They came after my partner and I. They were surveilling my house. We caught them. We caught them surveilling the house. Like I said, this story would take a long time to tell about why DEA was slow to react. I can just say, if management had been different all the way to the top, I think things would have been differently. But it doesn't take many cogs in that wheel to cause bad things to happen. But we documented surveillance on our homes. Nothing was done. On a little island like St. Croix, nothing was done. But ultimately, they machine gunned my partner's personal vehicle. And that day, I had been, one of my other task force partners and I, a guy named Chris. Chris and I had been babysitting Angel's son while he worked a second job. And so we came back that night to the house with Bombi, his little boy, the kind of kid that make you wish you had him. I'd never had children, but I think about Bombi. And, I wish I would have had kids. I mean, he makes you wish you had kids. But we dropped him off at the dropped off the house, kind of hung out for a little bit, had a little bite to eat with the family and everything, and dropped Bombi off, and then we all kind of left at the same time. Angel's dad, an old fisherman. He was an old St. Croix fisherman. He borrowed the truck that night, the truck that Angel and I always went fishing in. You could ride down the beach. It's just a little island truck, a little rusted out like Nissan island truck. Angel's father, as we're all leaving, his father took the truck and was going to use the truck for something that next day. And we all leave. Well, they were surveilling from a distance, probably from the mountain across the way. And so we all leave. Well, they knew Angel, that was his truck. And also Angel and I were always, we did stuff, we did it in that truck. But they let that truck get about a mile or two from the house into a kind of like a deserted part of the island, and then pulled up next to it in a full-size Dodge Ram pickup truck with two automatic weapons. And just let him have it. And luckily, his dad, I'm telling you, if there's a big guy upstairs, he was watching out for Magine. That's his nickname, was Magine, Angel's father. But somebody's watching out for him. He took five rounds. They were all skimming shots across his face. One went through a lip and in his teeth, but all of them were, and they were still rifled. I mean, they were still spinning straight and true through the window. So he took those across the face. The one that almost killed him went through his arm. It went through the door metal on the car and keyhole. The bullet turned sideways, full metal jacket bullet turned sideways, hit him in the arm and nicked his brachial artery. But nevertheless, they stopped their truck in front of him to finish it. They figured probably it was either my partner or me or both of us. But they come back and Magine, who had been shot, he was still conscious. He saw them gather the truck, putting magazines in their rifles through the shattered glass in the windshield. He carried a .357 Magnum because he worked for a restaurant and he did their night deposits for their money. So he had a permit to carry. And he had a little .357 Magnum in the truck with him. Well, he just shot right through the windshield at him. He got five or six rounds. He passed out before he could get that sixth round off. But that was enough to scare those guys back into the truck, figuring it's one or both of us still alive and getting out of there. And then the ball rolled hill down from there. We arrested a bunch of the people that we knew were involved in other things, but we couldn't get them for that point in time, but we had them on other charges, and the federal magistrate down there let them all go on bond, which is, yeah. So, but that was, in the end analysis, that was the best thing that could have happened, because over the course of the next 8 months, we had 11 or 12 primary bad guys and a whole lot of secondaries and tertiary bad guys. But the primaries in that case, of the 11 primaries, eight of them were killed within that next, 8 months to 10 months. Some of them were killed typical island fashion, where somebody just runs up real quick and shoots you a bunch of times while you're playing dominoes in like a little place or whatever. Other ones were pretty spectacular, getting shot from a distance, a team coming in, looked like paramilitary, and taking them out. But in the end analysis, all those bad guys, except for three primaries, they were all wiped out. I mean, very well done. In that time period, and the final three end up getting theirs. I think the two two of them end up getting life in prison without federal life in or life in prison. So it had a happy ending, but it took a little bit of time. The island was safe for everybody to go back. I know my partner, Mijito, his whole family had a little girl, a little boy, and his wife. They evacuated them off of St. Croix. They ended up being able to go up and visit my parents way up north in Ohio and get to see snow for the first time and go sled riding and all that. And so they had a nice time being evacuated. But it was actually, by the time it was all said and done, they had a safe place to go back to. All the main bad guys, they were all kaput. And nice. And the secondary and tertiaries, they either went to jail or they were so afraid because they didn't know who did it. And it was done professionally. I mean, some of the hits, they were done quite well. And so a lot of those bad guys for a couple of years after that were like, oh boy, let's hide in the basement for a while.
Did you get any insight on who was behind those hits?
Nope. Nobody ever solved that one.
Did anybody try?
I don't know.
It's 5 o'clock. We got to go. Yeah, we'll work on this case next week. Yeah.
It might have been a cleared by exception for the, I don't know, but yeah, it never, nothing ever came of it. And
what did it seem to you to be? Was it a rival gang? Or did they piss? I mean, was something, normally most of the cartels or some of those other ones, they're just brute force. They come in, they shoot everything up, they do everything up. This sounds more, you know, I hate to say it, this sounds more like something like a nation state. This sounds like somebody, you know, special forces training or something like that. Special operators who come in, don't leave a footprint, you know, and then they're gone.
I have my theories on what happened, and I just leave it at that.
That's why I was saying I have some theories too. They rhyme with Delta, you know, or
all I can tell you is I would just tell you that you know, like I said, there were a couple that were, they weren't sloppy, but they were the way you do it on that island. If you were another bad guy on that island, there was like two that were kind of like, you know, I can get that one. But the bulk of them were done, and I would say quite well. Yeah.
You know, and I love the story you told about your Virgin Island partner and his family coming to the U.S. for safety. And it's a testament to the law enforcement culture that they got to go visit your family, probably stay in that area for a while. Ohio, right?
It was. And I'll tell you, what warmed my heart is, you know, my mom and dad never ever pushed me to have kids or anything like that, and what have you. But I knew that I saw when they came up, my dad loved the kids. And but Bombi, we were going someplace in the snow, and Bombi was freezing cold in the back seat. We're all like squeezed into the back seat of a car, and Dad was doing the same thing to Bombi that he did for me. He had both of his hands between his like this, and whatever reminded me when I was, you know, 9 years old or whatever. And I saw how much Dad loved that kid and whatever. But it was a nice thing, and those kids got to see me break my leg. Well, we had some old luge. Those old luges, like from back in the 1910s, 1880s, we had
you mean the ones made out of wood.
Yeah. We had a couple of those from way back in the day, and we have. And I would, I mean, Ohio, where we live, it has. And they're not mountains by Alaska standards, but back home we call them mountains. They're really foothills. But we had this giant long slope back behind the house, and the kids had never been in snow before, so we had like those little bathtub sleds and some regular, like, you know, ones you won't kill yourself on sleds. But the kids are on this, and this is a really big hill and fast. And but yeah, we're back there. And so on Hell and I, of course, we have our little testosterone moment. Let's have a race. And my dad's with us, and we have those things. Well, my Belgian sheepdog at the time was like my best friend. Her name was Cammy. Big black Belgian sheepdog. I think she's a Dutch Shepherd mix. Got her to dog pound. But she's like one of the most important things. She's down there with the kids romping the snow at the bottom of the hill. On Hell and I get on the sleds, and we start going down. I'm laying down backwards, just like you see in the Olympics. You know, you're laying down backwards, flying. We're going down there. Well, Cammy sees us coming, and it didn't need to get worse and worse on this guy, because they tortured him. They did things to this poor old man that, I mean, everything, you just let your imagination run wild with what you can do to butcher somebody up. And that's what they did to this old cop. And they did it because they knew people would talk about it. And they wanted to scare everybody from the feds to the state guys on the different islands and all the way over into the BVIs, into the British Virgin Islands. But they really worked that guy over by the time it was all said and done. But yeah, so we're investigating that. And
I'm sorry,
like not the full size combat boots, but like hiking boots, you know, like the mids. Yes, it was a process. It took years to make this happen. I was only down there for the 2 years and change, and we formulated the base of, you know, who had done it, how it had happened, and what have you. But it took years after that to get everybody. I broke my leg clean. Like, if you take a guillotine, you couldn't have broken that lower part above the ankle any more clean than if you'd taken a guillotine. And yeah, your leg's all flappy. and all that, but Cameo's okay. Cameo's okay and whatever. And the kids, and when I did that, after I broke my leg, I flipped through the air and did like this like cartwheel through the air, kind of spectacular looking kind of thing. And the kids were like cheering like, USA, USA. Bombi and Angelica thought that I meant to do that. And somehow I ended up breaking my leg.
Yeah, I meant to be in a cast for, you know, the next 12 months.
yeah. So they got to see a bunch of things there in Ohio. Oh, they got to see a monster truck pull. They're originally from the islands down there. They'd never seen like that. And I know there was, I'd never seen a monster truck pull either. So we all got to see something for the first time. But it was in Pittsburgh. They had one of those. And so we took the kids up to go see a monster truck pull. So it was that's probably the funnest evacuation for an assassination attempt you ever had.
Did you get evacuated?
Yeah. So
I didn't think so.
Even with them surveilling our, well, let's go ahead and just get down that road. So even with them surveilling the house and we had that if you remember that PTAR system that first started up, it was a program in DEA so that the SACs, the special agents in charge, and they would go all the way up to the assistant administrators or what have you. It was a method from the field, the really important cases, the ones you would consider like an OSIDEF case or really good cases, they were kept up to date. Like right there on the spot, what you're doing in the field. And so that PTAR system had just started when we got down there. This was all documented. So we were documenting everything in these reports, but went to PTARs. We had multiple, before the assassination attempt, we had multiple sources of information and confidential informants come in and said, hey, these guys are going to come for you once you get to their hierarchy. And we made it perfectly clear to DA management that these guys are, and their response was, you kids have been watching too many movies. That'll never happen.
Yeah, you got to love that. Oh, man.
Yeah. And so, when this all happens, not to see Holly hindsight or anything, but it was not a surprise when this whole thing came down, they machine gunned that car. We'd been waiting for something like that to happen for a year and a half. And, but they dropped the ball. And like I said, this is not an indictment for DEA because the bosses I've had before and after, phenomenal, unbelievable men and women, unbelievable. But you know, if you're that right space or wrong place in space and time, and something bad like that happens, and so yeah, all I can say is management dropped the ball. It took them, I think, almost 4 or 5 days to get Angel off the island and his family. They never even offered to take my wife off the island, and so after that, and then the bad guys get let go. They get out on bond and whatever and all that. So ultimately I had to walk into the office of my boss, who I like my group supervisor, but I had to say, listen, I don't understand. I mean, I'm still a fairly new Asian. I'm very respectful. I'm not being an a-hole, you know, but I walked to my boss's office and I said, I don't even understand what's happening here. I said, but if they don't get my wife off the island in the next 2 days, I'm going to turn in my badge and I'm going to walk right into Fox News or whoever gives a shit and have a sit down about, 'cause there's a lot of corruption that had happened down there that nobody was talking about. That nobody wanted to say anything about, all the way into the U.S. Attorney's office. And Jack knew I liked him and I liked Jack. And I said, so you can mince my words to the sack or you can tell them exactly how I said it, but this is what's going to happen. And they had my wife off the island in about a day and a half. But that's what it took. And like I said, not an indictment for DEA because my experience throughout with everything else, everywhere else I've been, like in those shootings that I was in, treated like gold. But that right there, that was one of those ones that, it's still a head shaker for a lot of us about how that happened. But ultimately, I was there for about another month and change. And at that point in time, we had a wiretap up and running. And they came over the wiretap. And what they'd called my partner and I, Majito and I, they had called us the twin gunmen. That was their phrase for us because everywhere we went Majito and I went, we had our subguns, M4s. Because we were always ready to get into it. I mean, these guys had AK-47 full autos. We had good information. They had belt-fed weapons, possibly explosives. That's the bad guys. So, I mean, we were always but anyway, they referred to us as the twin gunmen. But they came over a wire and they said they knew that my partner was off the island, but they knew I was still there. And they said on the wire, they said get the lone gunman or whatever. And so I got a call from the office. I was off that night. Like at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was back at my place and I got the call and they said, what are you doing? Are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm good to go. And they're like, well, be ready at 9 o'clock in the morning. We've got plane tickets. You're out. They just said some things on the wire that says they're coming. So that was that.
Wow. You know, and I don't know if you know this or not, Rick, but when Javier was down in Colombia, Bogota, twice they got information that the Sicarios were on their way to his apartment to kill him. The first time they called him and said, hey, you know, where are you at? Well, they called him in his apartment. So that's where he is, because we didn't have cell phones back then. But the boss told him, said, you got your gun? He's like, yeah, why do I need a gun? They said, get in your G car, keep your eyes open and get to the embassy immediately. Sicarios are on the way to meet you.
What did he do? So he does. Three girls in his apartment.
Had to get them out first. But he, you know, he makes the embassy. And so what do? You would think they'd evacuate him. They moved him into another apartment. And then it happened later, several months later, again, they had to move him again. And even when I was in Miami, we locked up some Haitians with 500 keys of coke. And as they're going through trial, the DEA-based radio operator got a recorded phone call from somebody saying they were going to put a hit on me as I was going into the courthouse in Miami. And DEA's instructions were, keep your eyes open, be careful, take a different route home every day.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you know, something else that should have been a warning light for me is when I came onto Island, they had the moving company finally gets there with the goods to my condo. And it's a team of Rastafarians and whatever and kids and what have you. They're all locals. They come in and then they give me my paperwork, and right at the top of the invoice, it says Drug Enforcement Administration. And so everybody on that island knows where the DEA guy lives before you even, you're only there for like about a week and a half, and they know where you. So that was how dunce, that was another dunce move on the part of whoever that was. I mean, because now everybody knows, it's a point of pride to know where the DEA and ATF and the FBI people are and all that on those islands. Yeah. And they don't have to even work for it. Don't have to follow you home from the federal building or try to catch you unawares or whatever. They know immediately where you're at. Have your number.
They just stop by and have coffee with you.
Yeah. And I would say, I forgot to mention, you know, when they finally pulled the plug and said, get out, I left at 9 o'clock in the morning. That next morning, sometime in the early morning hours, they hit the condo right down below. I had a really big condo, like a second and third floor condo. And then there's a smaller condo, underneath me, but, they came in and they hit that condo underneath me. They had been watching from an angle. We knew where they'd been surveilling. There's only a couple of places you could surveil my place from. And one was a hilltop that had a bad angle. But yep, they hit the place down below me that night after I left. And it would have been bad. I'm not the biggest badass in the world, but I would tell you that I do a lot of shooting, a lot of tactical stuff and competition stuff and everything else. And I had a lot of things in that condo. I'll just say several big automatic weapons, not 9mm 223. I had some pretty good firepower in there, and whatever. And also it was a hardened condo. I had done some things and whatever. You'd have to have a chop saw in about 15 minutes to get into the place.
Wow.
And if they had hit when I was at home, they'd still be talking about that for the next, I don't know, 100 years on St. Croix. But they hit the place down below, which is just a kind of a wimpy door, wimpy thing. They went in there, didn't steal anything. Luckily, the kid that lived below us, he wasn't home. He was somewhere off island or whatever. But they didn't steal one thing. And they went in there, they rifled through a couple things and didn't take one thing and were out. So.
See, personally, I would have used sharks with frickin' laser beams to, defend my territory there, along with, nothing like a good, healthy 7.62 or 5.56, or 30 caliber to just get, it's an attention getter. You know, if nothing else, it does get your attention.
7.62 in this case.
Yeah, I had a full auto 308, full auto 7.62x50. Anyway, yeah, so I had some pretty good stuff going on. I had my M4 subgun, Benelli M4 Super 90, had some pretty good stuff going on in there, but they would have really had to work to get into that house. It's all masonry with those big, they had like the storm louvers that you see in the Caribbean. When you have like a really bad hurricane, you've got these metal storm louvers, but we're on a second and third floor. So first, then they had to climb up a ladder to even get to the windows. And then you've got steel shuttered windows. So the only way into that place was to come through that crazy up armored two door system in the front. I will say too, going back, that month and a half that I was there after the event had happened with the assassination attempt, DEA didn't put me someplace else or move me around the island or whatever. I went back to the same place I'd been surveilling for the last year and a half. And, so the way I would do that is I would drive a different route home every day. I'd speed through places you shouldn't speed through to watch my tail. And then when I'd get anywhere near, I was in a pretty decent sized complex and whatever, I'd park in different places on this mountainside. I'd never park in front of my place. I'd park different places every day for that 30 days. And then I'd hike through the rainforest. And then I'd sit in the rainforest with my weapons and watch my door and smell and smell for pot, smell for people smoking a cigarette waiting for me, hiding down below, watch around. And then that's how I'd go home every night. Every night, that's how I went home. If I went to the store to get food, Oh yeah. If I had to go to the grocery store to, you know, pick up some groceries, when I first went to the island, I tried to look like some kind of expat. You know, I've never had like a thick head of hair since I was in the army. I think the helmet rubbed that off, but nevertheless, I tried to have like, you know, kind of like shit ass clothes on and look like kind of like a crumb bum when I'd go around St. Croix. But after that, I'm like, well, everybody knows what's going on now anyway. So I'd go to the grocery store. I had full kit, had my M4 slung up, two handguns, some other things, full on rig. And I figured, because if I'm going to get into it, at least everybody's going to know who got into it. And that's how I'd walk in, and people would be uncomfortable. You'd see like tourists, and they'd be like, "What? I'm going to a different tourist destination next year." But yeah, so that's how that lasts. I have to go to Beirut. Maybe I'll go to Beirut next year. Be better. Yeah, but yeah, no. So that's how that last 30 days went until I finally left out of there.
So you're the reason the cruise ship stopped coming to St. Croix. There's Rick and the grocery shopping again. You're
right. Yeah, yeah.
I'm gonna have to go someplace safer, like downtown Chicago. You know, that's where I think I'm gonna go on vacation.
Yeah, right.
Great story to say welcome to DEA.
I'm telling you. Well, hey, just to back up a step about the cruise ships. So this is how bad it was. The island, we had a Hovensa oil refinery on St. Croix. And I think they said, I'm terrible with numbers, but I think that they refined over 35% of all the jet fuel used by the U.S. military, aside from other fuels, they refined there on St. Croix. And so when the cruise ships pulled out and said, we're not coming, and that was all of them. Like, I don't know if it was like Princess or, you know, all the major ones. They said, we're not coming. They actually tried to sweeten up a deal and say, hey, listen, we'll fuel you up for pennies on the dollar in our refinery if you still come back to the island. And they're like, nah, we're good. That's how bad it was.
Wow.
It's a shame too. Wow. It's a shame. And I would say this goes to not just St. Croix, but I wanted to backtrack to Pittsburgh as well on this one. But you know, when you go into these areas that look bad, whether it's like a bad inner city neighborhood or whether it's a place like St. Croix where you see all that ugly, but the reality of it is, 70% of the people there are unbelievably good people. Even like in some of the neighborhoods you see in the bigger cities, like I know my experience in Pittsburgh, policing the second most violent part of Pittsburgh, is that the majority of the people there, you make fast friends, and they are good people. They're just in a bad spot, either economically or their whole family lives there or whatever. But St. Croix was the same thing. We made more friends there, I think, than we did when we were in Yakima, Washington, when it came to outside of law enforcement friends.
Well, hell yeah, because you weren't shooting anybody in St. Croix. I mean,
we're just getting shot at.
Shot at, that's a difference. Now you're a victim. Now, hey, I'm getting shot at, you know? Well, so now, but Alaska came after St. Croix, right?
It did.
Yeah, because I was going to say that this whole episode is what prepared you to take on that grizzly bear. It's like, yeah, I've dealt with this kind of shit before. People coming for me. I got you. So you're down there. You said you did 2 years and some change. What was you were kind of talking about, that was the final kind of straw that broke the camel's back, that you said you had to go somewhere?
That was it. So they pulled me off island, and I had what they do with no matter what is they always give you, like, I think it was three. You can choose three places when they say it's time to go. You can choose three places that are like small field offices where you're like either a resident office or a district office, and then you get two choices that are like big field division offices, and then they generally try to figure out a place for you to go from those five picks. And so luckily for me, there was a spot coming open in Anchorage. It wasn't open yet, but they did pulled a couple. One of the supervisors up here had known about the shootings in Yakima and said, "Hey, we got to have that kid up here." So, but he'd been a supervisor in Seattle for a while. But this fella found out that I was leaving St. Croix, and so he kind of pulled a couple strings, and I ended up being able to get up here into Anchorage. But one of the best things that ever happened to me in my life. Got to thank his name was Tony Grotens. I got to thank that guy because he did me one of the biggest favors anybody's done me in my entire adult life.
But I got to tell you, you go from St. Croix to wear a pair of shorts, you know, some tank tops, and now you're going to Alaska. Could you have picked two divergent, you know, weather patterns, you know, two divergent environments I could see St. Croix going to Florida, St. Croix, maybe even going to, you know, California, but Alaska.
Your observations are correct. My tan lines, my bikini lines were gone pretty quick when we came up here. And, the other thing too, is I'd say, you know, that when it comes to like culture shock or whatever, I went from having blue azure, you know, at the blue waters and the blue skies and the tropical greens and flowers. And we came up here, I think it was in like March, what's still winter here in March for the house hunting trip. Came up here and it's all snow and black rock. And that's those are your two colors, and maybe some sky, but usually, but yes, it's coming from that. But I know when I first got to the Anchorage district office, I go to meet everybody, and I'm walking around. This is the end of a dead of winter, like a long, hard winter. And I had never believed in, I always thought seasonal affective disorder was like a cop out, or I just never really believed it. Well, I believe it now because we walk around that office and I'm talking to people and I'm like, oh no, it seems kind of off. People seem a little bit off, like just like, I don't know, they seem like down and off. But then when I came back and worked until June, everybody's gregarious and funny and they're back to being normal. But that was the other culture shock, is going from that sunlight all the time to where you do have a lot of darkness. And you can see the difference in people at the end of a long Alaskan winter. I mean, it's not like they're zombies or anything, but you can definitely see a difference in personality if you're not taking your vitamin D and what have you, and sitting in front of a sun lamp or getting out in cross-country skiing where you can get some sunlight. But you could definitely see that difference in behavior when you came up here.
You know, you went from blue waters to blue balls up there, didn't you?
Oh, man. I'm telling you, it'll make you believe it. Yep.
The boys are cold.
Well, there's a bunch of rules you have to follow when you first come up here, especially if you're going to travel around the state, like up into Nome in the dead of winter or Fairbanks or what have you. And the coldest that I've seen it up here was minus 54. And that's cold enough that I found out that when you go, if you have to pee while you're outside, first of all, it's a 25-minute task because you have to get, you know, three or four or five layers of clothing off to get there. But then when you finally do, it never hits the ground. When you go to take that whiz, it kind of like just turns into magic pixie dust. And I don't know, Greta Thunberg's crying down there someplace for global warming because you just contributed to it. But nevertheless, yeah, it's so cold that it just vaporizes, let alone a pot of water. You put a pot of water up into the air, it just goes, makes this funny sound like
before too, and just, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The tires on your car.
You know, I can't imagine minus 54. I can't even imagine. I think plus 54 is chilly.
It's something else. Yeah, the tires on your car flatten. So like when your car sits overnight, you have to plug it in, by the way. I don't know if you ever saw the plugs up here. They look like the old drive-in movie theater. For youngsters, probably don't know what that is, but the old drive-in movie theater type things. Well, they're plug-ins for cars, and you'll have them at hotels, any place where you're going to park up for a while to plug your car in. You have your little blanket heaters for your engine block and for your batteries and whatever and all that. But yeah, so they have that going on. But your tires are flat. Like when your car sits there all night, your tires, where it's sitting, that part of them is flat. And so for the first half mile of when you go to pull out, for the first half mile, it's like being in a Fred Flintstone mobile or something where it's like flop, 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 until the tires warm up enough where that flat spot goes out of them. But it's just a different world. If you're graced enough to have longer hair, so more, you definitely have to follow this rule with that luscious head of hair you have. But if you wash your hair and it's still kind of wet, and then you walk out to your mailbox, like in the morning when it's minus 25, 35 out, your hair can actually crack off. Like for people who have really long hair, like gals, yeah, you better come in and wait for a second before you try to deal with it. Because if you try to comb it out or whatever, it can actually just crack off. That's how cold it gets when it's like down to minus 35 and whatever. It's different. Yeah, definitely different.
Here's a little weather factoid for you. At what temperature does Fahrenheit and Celsius mean the same?
Zero.
Nope.
32.
Nope. Minus 40.
There isn't one.
Yeah, there is. Minus 40. 40. Minus 40 Fahrenheit is the same temperature as minus 40 centigrade.
Okay.
There you go.
There's like 10 seconds of our lives we'll never get back again.
You know, when I'm out there sitting, when my testicles are frozen to a rock when I'm cross-country skiing, taking a break, I'll remember that fact.
How did we get to testicles on a rock from minus 40? What are you doing? Are you that lonely out there? Do the rocks look that good after a few weeks?
You know what? I'm not saying. I'll keep my mouth shut now. But I'll remember that fact. Nevertheless, I'll remember that factoid whenever I'm sitting out there cross country skiing and I'm stuck to a rock somewhere.
Truth or dare?
Oh, I don't even want to know.
Hey, listen, Morg, I don't even, you know, the man to woman ratio up here back in like the 1940s and 50s, it was like, I think even into the 70s, it was still, I forget the numbers, but like 70-30 or something. But really, I mean, when you look back, I mean, it was a lonely place up here for dudes like back in the day. The numbers up here are pretty, you know, pretty normal now. But like up until the 70s or 80s, the odds were, and I think the saying up here was the odds are good, but the goods are odd or something like that. But yeah, the male to female ratio was a very scary thing back in the day.
And you were worried about somebody saying the bitch word on here to your mom and hearing that. Listen to what you're talking about now.
Now you're talking about your nuts being frozen to a rock. What are you taking a dump at minus? Who? I mean, you can't hold it till you get somewhere.
Do I get final editing rights on this one?
Hell no.
You know.
Ah, boy. Yeah, two words come up, time immemorial.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Rambo's tough. Rambo took a few craps in the jungle while, you know, when he escaped the jail there and you know, was hiding in the mountains. So, hey, you know, that's we would expect no less from somebody named Rambo. But so let's talk about you move up to Alaska, and this is where you spent the rest of your career. Is that correct?
Correct.
So when you move back up there, I mean, obviously, it's a huge adjustment between St. Croix and this. What was the hardest thing to adapt to going to? I mean, sometimes it sounds obvious, like it's just the weather, but like you were even saying, all the things you have to learn that only people who live there know. You know, it's like going out, you know, even with hair just a little bit. Yeah, Murph, you don't want to try this.
Can't afford to lose anymore.
But, you know, what were some of the biggest paradigm shifts for you going from St. Croix up there? Was it the way the communities worked? Was it the way law enforcement worked? You know, what were some big shifts for you?
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, actually, it was in the positive. For so long, there was no anonymity. You couldn't go in public. You couldn't do other without, we call it like pooping in your own kitchen, where you're seeing people you dealt with. Like even in Yakima, you couldn't go see a movie without seeing a family member or a friend of somebody that you had just smashed, you'd gotten arrested. And so, but the first thing, you know, Anchorage is a decent sized city, even though once you leave it, there's not a whole lot out there. But no, it was a good paradigm shift in that I finally felt like I had some anonymity to do things and nobody knew who you were to be, you know, to have to worry about that. The other thing that happened as well is I was lucky enough that the fellow whose position I was taking, he was a traveling show for DEA up here. And so he did casework in Anchorage, and that's what I ended up. I did some casework in Anchorage, but most of my casework was done. It would be like if you worked in Atlanta, Georgia, but you were doing casework in New York. That's how big the state is. You know, when you look at how long and how large Alaska is, working out of the Anchorage District Office, if I did a case down in Ketchikan, which is coastal Alaska down in the south, you know, way down south, that would be like if you were in Atlanta doing a case in Miami. That's how far apart they are. Or like New York all the way to Raleigh, Durham or whatever. So you have to fly to get there on an airliner and come back. And so that was really great for me because I was able to do really good casework. And especially when you look at some of the smaller places, those impact cases. And some of the impact cases would go all the way to the southwest border. So even though you're starting small in a little Alaska coastal fishing town, you would have cases that took you right down to the border or across the border. And so, but I love that aspect of being finally like kind of like being like a secret squirrel dude where I'm working there, but I'm not living there. So they don't know me. They don't see me. And all my police friends, they love the fact that the federal fist could come down on these places because a lot of these smaller towns, the bad guys had been there for time immemorial. I wouldn't say they got away with it, but you know, policing in a small town is a bit different. And so, and then when they did get time in Alaska, even though you'd think it would be super conservative up here, it's kind of a weird mix. But the sentencing structure wasn't all that great. And I'd call it a slap on the hand a lot of the time for these guys for drug charges and even for assaults and what have you. But we'd come in there and all of a sudden now they're looking at 20 years. And that resonates, especially when you come in. We had one investigation. I did this one with the Ketchikan Police Department. Those guys did a tremendous job down there for being a small town and having everybody bracketed to make this thing happen. But we arrested, I think it was almost over a dozen people in that town in one day. We went down in Blackhawks. We had two Blackhawk helicopters meet us in Juneau. Had to fly from Anchorage to Juneau. I met a couple of my Blackhawk buddy flyers, and we took the Blackhawks down to Ketchikan. And an hour and 50 minutes later, we had, I think, 14 people in custody and on the way back to federal court in Juneau. And but that they were telling me for the months after that, every bad guy in Ketchikan that we didn't arrest, that wasn't a part of that, they thought they were going to be a part of it because being federal, and they moved out of town. They said you could not get a seat on an airplane or on the Alaska Marine Highway, which is a big ferry that goes down to Washington from Alaska to take people back and forth. But they said that like for the next, like I guess like next 2 months, like every berth was filled heading south for all these people to get out of there because they figured they were in the next wave of coming in. Because we came in black Blackhawks and then just snatched them, like 2 hours later, we're gone with them. But those kind of cases are really rewarding. Yeah, because Oh yeah. And, you know, and I will tell you as well, you know, that we had one, I remember in particular on that case, there was this big fat piece of S pedo. That was one of the bad guys on that case where we came in the helicopters. He was a tubby. I mean, he looked like a movie pedophile, and he'd ply, you know, he'd ply young girls with methamphetamine and all that. He was the one guy out of 14 that decided to try to run and fight back. He decided he wanted to run and fight. And, yeah, so we all kind of know what happened from there with that. This guy wasn't used to that. And so we get him, and, he actually was, he was crying on the helicopter. He was crying. And so those are the kind of things that make every push-up you ever did in the military, every college credit hour, you know, that you had to languish through, and everything you went through in law enforcement, when you get to deal with somebody like that, and you know they're going away for a long time, and you see them cry, that is your payment. I could have gone without 3 or 4 or 5 paychecks and eaten ramen noodles for about a quarter or two just for that, moments like that.
Yeah, there's another similar event when you go in and clean up, not necessarily the biggest drug traffickers, but the most violent. I was on the Met team for 2.5 years out of Atlanta. And you go in these neighborhoods, and these people have terrorized these people. And you go in and build a case on them. And on roundup day, when you come driving out in your cavalcade with, you know, 20 police cars, and the neighbors can see in the back windows that these guys are going to jail, and they come out on the street and applaud you as you're driving down the street, that's a good feeling.
It really is. And, you know, to backtrack a bit, we talked about the reasons you go into law enforcement in the very beginning of the first episode and all that. I know that I said that a lot of it comes from popular culture and things you grew up with, kind of the mores and values from your family and all that. But I know I've always been as a kid, I was really a midget. And most of my friends were smaller kids too. And we saw bullying like you wouldn't believe. And I'm glad it happened. I mean, because it builds character. But I'll tell you, my entire life, one of the other reasons I went to law enforcement, why I wanted to stay an agent in the field and continue doing that is because I hate bullies. I hate people that they enjoy hurting people. It's like their shtick and whatever. But I mean, I've always had it out for bullies. And it's watching my friends get bullied. And then as I got older, seeing other things happen and whatever. And then going into law enforcement, when you're watching from afar, people victimizing each other. I mean, it's, yeah, that's one of the primary reasons I stayed as a field operational agent, because you just hate them. Absolutely hate them. And every time you can tune one up and get them where they need to go, that's just, it's almost like when you fall in love for the first time, you get that warm feeling in your heart. When you get one of those violators that is like that pedophile or some of the ones that have, you know, done their things, it just makes you feel warm inside.
I was going to say, speaking of warm feelings, you don't get many warm feelings up in Alaska when your balls are stuck to a rock. But we will I'll have to edit that again. Good gosh. There we go.
Mom, that's an allegory. I don't even know what an allegory is right now, but Mom, that was an allegory. I didn't really mean that.
I doubt your mom's going to listen to this. You think she will?
I don't think I'm going to forward the link. No.
What's your email address? We'll do it for you.
You know what? She's a gregarious old Italian gal, school teacher. She'll like it. She'll think it's funny. Yeah, I'm good. I'm still in the will.
Well, so how many years did you? So when was your final year? When did you move to Alaska? And when was your final year with DEA?
Yeah, so arrived in Alaska in 2004 and then retired in 2021.
Because I was thinking there was a couple cases up there. One of them was a guy named, actually, believe it was Robert Hansen or Richard Hansen. It was one of the serial killers, but he died. No, Robert Hansen, same one as the FBI traitor. And then there was that Israel Keys, I think his name was. Did you ever have, he was operating in and around Anchorage. Did you ever hear about any of those cases while you were up there?
I did. Alaska is a very small place. And I think it's probably my first couple of weeks up here. One of the task force agents with our you know, group there in Anchorage asked me if I'd go down to Spring Creek, which was where the real bad people in Anchorage are sent for state prison. Spring Creek, it's down in Seward, Alaska. It's a pretty good drive, about a 3.5-4 hour drive in winter to get down there, 4 hour drive. So we see to do an interview. So we went down to interview somebody, and we're in kind of like, I remember we're looking through this window down onto like the cafeteria area while we're waiting to go interview this person. And I see this one broken down looking turd sitting down there at a table. He's in a wheelchair. He's all by himself. And he just looks like a little broken down little man. And he's all by himself. There's no one else around. And I asked one of the jailers or one of the prison guards, what's the deal with that guy down there? And he goes, that's Butcher Baker. And I'm so new to the state. I hadn't read the book or known about the guy, but it was your Hansen guy. It was that Butcher Baker guy. He was the fellow that back in, I think it was what, like the late 70s, 80s, he was taking
money. Yeah, I think up in their 90s. Yeah, and John Cusack played him in a movie. I mean, did a really good job. I think the Alaska trooper who kind of led that investigation, we were trying to track him down at one point to see if we could interview him. But that was an interesting movie. And it just showed you how the difference being in Alaska changed how you could do. I mean, planes are a huge part of life up there, right? You know, you fly, you got to fly places. It's not like, hey, let's get in the car and drive. It's like, no, that would be a 3-day trip. We're just going to hop in our plane. And, you know, which kind of leads me to the question, you know, a lot of people have, what percentage of people in law enforcement do you think were pilots?
Well, troopers, I would say probably 40% of the troopers are pilots up here. But to give you an idea of, you talk about private aircraft and how planes play an integral role in Alaskans' lives. There's a lake out there by the Anchorage International called Lake Hood. There are more float planes and more personally owned planes on that one lake by the airport out there than the entire lower 48 combined. If that gives you an idea of how heavy the state is for personally owned aircraft, more at one lake by the airport than the rest of the lower 48 combined. But yeah, so that Hansen guy, yeah, he's one that for people that don't know out there, he's a little unassuming little baker. He had a little baking shop. He looked like a kind of a little wimpy kind of guy, but he would kidnap prostitutes and then brutalize them, get them into his Super Cub. You know, he had a little thing to tie them down so they couldn't move in the Cub, and then he'd take them out in the middle of nowhere, land the plane, and kill them out there. I mean, I know a lot of people said they hunted them. I don't know how far that would be if he'd like chase them through the woods, but I know he'd take them out there, and that's where he'd kill them and leave the bodies. And ultimately, he ended up getting caught by. Yeah,
they were still identifying victims with DNA after 37 years. I think they tied a couple more to him. So.
Well, I can tell you, so we go on to Israel Keyes. This is when I first came up here. This would have been about probably a couple years after I arrived in Alaska. My task force that I was on was an interdiction group out of our main office. So we had a sub office right at the airport. And so during lunchtime, that's where I'd go do my run. There was a coastal trail that goes along the water, really pretty. And so at lunchtime, I'd just run from the office and hit that coastal trail and go. Well, this would have been about probably 2006, maybe 2006, 2007. I run every other day. I ran that trail and I'm out running and I go past, this guy's walking towards me. And you know, I would tell people, always follow your instincts, always follow your intuitions. If you have a bad feeling about something, it's not just Han Solo and Luke Skywalker on the Millennium Falcon getting in and Obi-Wan getting near the Death Star when you're like, I have a bad feeling about this. I'm running down the trail. I have this guy walking towards me. It's a bright day, middle of daytime, walking towards me. And I always carry my 45 and two magazines and this little combat knife. So I always have it with me. So I'm armed. I'm running along the trail. I see this guy walking towards me and he is looking at me like a predatory animal, even though he's not like growl or like, the look in his eyes and just the look on his face, he's looking like through me, like looking right as I'm coming. And that look does not change. And as I go, I said, hi. So I'm always friendly to everybody, you know, and just see what, almost like a ping, like every, like one ping Vasily in Red October to get a feel for him and see how they're, you know, see what their reaction is going to be. But I run by the guy and I'm like, hey, how you doing? And he just looks at me and nods his head with that same predatory look. And I can tell you that in the 20 years I've been up here, I've done it, I think twice, where I turn around and run backwards until I don't see him anymore. I turned around and ran backwards for like 50 yards backwards until that guy was around the corner. And just because I had that feeling, something was really, really wrong with this guy. Came around the corner and there's this college age girl that's just walking. And so I stopped and I had my badge on a lanyard. So I pulled it out well before I got to her. And I said, hey, listen, I don't want to scare you or anything, but there's a guy that just went past me and there's something wrong or something really off with that guy. You might want to walk it the way you came from. Maybe go that way because there's something wrong. And she was very nice. And she was like, well, I really appreciate it. She goes, I think I'm just going to go to my car. And we were parked in the same lot. So I went ahead and walked back with her to her car. She left, I left. And then it was like 6 years later or whatever, when it all started coming to light about him and they had his picture up and he had admitted to going to that trail and trying to find a place that he could kill a couple people with a suppressed rifle. And ultimately he did. He went back there and he was going to kill a couple in their car on the trailhead for that. And a homemade suppressor for a rifle. He sat up on him getting ready to do it. Well, one of the airport police officers that cover that area pulled in a patrol car to check them out. He admitted to FBI and to APD that he is going to, in fact, was going to kill all three of them. And then a second police car pulled in and he pulled back and didn't do it. So he was stalking that trail as a surveillance to figure out where he could set up, how he could kill somebody along that trail. And that was him. I know it seems like fantastical, but actually ran into that guy.
And And you're, so all these years later, I mean, or like when you saw him and then you saw that picture later, I mean, there's no doubt in your mind it was this same guy.
No doubt at all. And right about that same time, he wasn't long in there before he killed himself in jail. He double redundant.
His wrist and hung himself. Yeah.
And hung himself. Yeah. So he double redundant, kind of like his little joke. I think it's his little joke that he gets to take his secrets to the grave with him because they suspect he had killed some other people in other states. He had murder kits that had cashed up in other states.
He had stashed all over the United States. Yeah. Man, you know, it's one of those things, right? It's that instinct that, you know, the sixth sense, you know, like that movie, you know, where it's just, isn't it amazing how people like that put off vibes? I mean, was it his look? I mean, the way you were describing it, it almost felt like you could sense the evil just as you're going by this guy. Not only is it the look, but it's like, you get that feeling is like, man, the hair's on the back of my neck. Not that you have much hair, but what hair you had was, you know, on the back of your neck, you know, it's going up, but it's like, but yeah, it just, I've never been, you know, next to a serial killer like that, but you do get next to people who are just freaking evil. And was it just that feeling of evil just besides the look, or what really locked you in on this guy to say, there's something wrong?
Well, you know, the other thing too is I knew that he was sizing me up. I mean, it wasn't just that feeling like this, there's something really, really wrong with this guy. You could tell that there was just something off with this guy that was really, really bad. But it was the way that he looked at me. He looked at me like maybe I'm looking at somebody that I'm getting ready to interview, you know, for in a criminal investigation. That was like, it just, he was sizing me up. He was trying to figure out what I was about. There was no doubt about it.
Man. Oof. So when you saw that picture, you know, 6 years later, was it instantaneous? Did you recognize the picture right away?
It was. Yeah, I looked at that and I'm like, there's no way. And I mean, I had to think about it for a couple of days and then went back to it and looked at it. I'm like, yep, that was him.
Yeah.
Damn.
Dang.
I know.
Well, good thing you were armed, man.
When you were running backwards, did you catch him turn around looking at you?
He glanced back one time. And then just kept on walking, never looked back again.
No, I was going to say, you went running armed, not, I mean, a lot of people, they're armed all the time up there, not just because of bad people, right? But because of the wildlife, you know, like you say, you never know if you're going to run into a bear or something else, right? So going around armed. And if I remember right, I think the commissioner, when I met him one time, or may have been on one of those episodes, but I understand that one of the traffic laws up there is if you're stopped by the police, it's okay to carry a gun. You just have to let them know you're armed at that time or that you're carrying a weapon. Is that still correct?
That is correct. You can carry without a permit up here. You can carry concealed, but you do have to, if a police officer pulls you over, you have to tell them where the weapon is and all that. Yes.
Okay. Man. So, you finished out, what led you to punch out? Was it just that time you have enough years in, or did you have something else you wanted to do?
Well, it was a combination. I mean, it really, most of the things I do in my life is like a BB in a gallon jug. I just make a decision and go with it and make it simple. But there was actually a lot of reasons for retiring. One of the primaries was they were making us get vaccinated. And feel how you will about that whole vaccination thing, and especially looking back now and looking at where we are today. But I didn't want to get that vaccination. And when they put that moratorium down, or that you're gonna get vaccinated, I didn't want to get vaccinated. And if that was a road they were going to take to make us do that, then I think it's about pretty close to time for me being able to get out of there. I didn't have any jobs on the horizon. I write, and I'm an editor for a magazine, the Firearms News Magazine. It's the oldest magazine, gun magazine in the country. So my last couple of years of DEA, it's hard for DEA to allow you to have outside employment. You have to go through a lot of hoops to be able to do anything. I think they were day drinking that day when I sent the request to write. I was approached by a couple of people, you know, that work with the magazine to write for them. And I told them I didn't have any high hopes it was going to happen, but I went ahead and did my thing with DEA and they actually let me do it. So for the last 2 years of my career, I was doing the writing and doing editing for that magazine and all that, but it's more of a hobby than a full-time job. And so really I had nothing on the horizon, but there was, so I retired. Partly it was because of the vaccination. And then also I think it's when you're with a bunch of younger, you know, younger agents and you start using references, even if you're using like a major reference from our time period and they just look at you like, brr, you know, they don't get it. That I noticed over the last 4 or 5 years that like I'd say things and there was no reaction, no laughter. They'd look at me like that poor old, like a pariah, like that poor old man. No way, grandma, no way, grandpa. But there was a couple of different things that I knew that it was time to bang out. I knew that when I went through an entire high risk, middle of 3 o'clock in the morning warrant with my granny glasses, because we've been sitting in the car for about an hour or two and I was like reading something and then all of a sudden we had to hit the place. when you go through an entire three-story house with your weapons and kicking in doors and whatever, and we finally get done and the dust is settling, and I realize I had my reading glasses down over my like Grandma Santa Claus or whatever. I had them down over my nose, and I'd done the whole work with my glasses down over my nose. I realized maybe it might be time to think about, you know, passing on the reins. Yeah.
See, yep. I know when I'm doing speeches, I was in Montreal and Cleveland over the last 2 days. I was on four planes in 2 days. But you can tell what the age of the audience is when you make Monty Python jokes, you make certain references, and then, you know, the people laugh. But you're talking about my one imitation I do, and I think I do, it's a pretty good one. You're talking about, you know, give me one ping. So give me one ping, Vasily. One ping only, please. See?
Excellent.
Not a bad Sean Connery.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Careful, Ryan. Some things don't react well to bullets. You know, anyway, Hunt for Red October.
Great movie. Now, well, that was good. Borg, one thing I'd say too is, I mean, my entire time here in Alaska with my coworkers and almost every boss I've had has been phenomenal. So it wasn't that at the very end, as far as the way the stress goes, but it got increasingly difficult to work, you know, with the U.S. attorney's offices and some of the prosecutors and other parts of the countryside up here and whatever. And you realize that the stress that the job is creating, it's not going through a door at 2 o'clock in the morning or interviewing a bad guy or any of those things associated with that part of the job. It's having to fight a fight to be able to do your job and to go after people and protect the public when you're fighting the people that should be supporting you as hard as you're fighting to get a case initiated and go. And what I would say is, you know, one of the things, like the last 3 years of my job, I was out running one night and I'm looking way up on this mountainside where there's a little red light up there. Somebody's like running a trail with a red light thing. And I noticed on my right eye that it looked weird. Like the left eye, I could see the light. My right eye, it looked shaded. Like there was almost like a tint. I get back to the house. I'm looking at lights in the house, and there was a perfectly round circle in my field of vision on my dominant eye, on my shooting eye. And I'm like, oh boy, I have all kinds of things in my head, like what it could be. So I go to a retinologist and they do their full court press on it. And he says, you're in luck. It's not like cancer. It's not this. And he names like one of those Latin, like it's like four or five different part Latin terms for what the problem is. And, but what it was, he goes, it's a bubble on your retina. And he goes, what causes it? It's almost like high blood pressure. He said, he's really being stressed. He said, we see this commonly in combat veterans, police officers. I think it's also surgeons and school teachers. But he said that we see this, and what it is, it's a stress, and it causes that bubble to pop on your eye. And that's what you're seeing in your field of vision. And he goes, it heals itself. It can heal itself. He goes, there's three things we can do. We can do surgery, which I don't suggest. We can do medicine. I don't suggest that either. He goes, and he knew what I did for a living. Or he goes, third, you can quit being pissed off all the time. And I didn't realize how effing mad I was when we'd try to do something and we got shut down, or they try to push us off on a case. This involved people, you know, good people getting hurt, and we're getting pushed back by the powers that be. And that was where the pressure, that's where the anger was coming from. It wasn't from my coworkers or a bad boss. They were angels that walked the earth. Even the bad guys, it was that. But so where I'm getting at with this whole, the little organ recital, as you get older, you talk about all the things you have wrong with your body, organ recital. The reason I'm doing my little mini organ recital on the eye problem is that, so I retire, and a month and a half later, it was gone, and it's never come back since. That spot that in my field of vision. So that right there was definitely an indicator of how angry, you know, that you are, and what the effects it has physiologically on your body and whatever. The minute you retire, a month and a half later, that goes away to never to return again.
And if it's not the eye, then it's like some kind of ulcer, or it's kind of you've got some. There's other stress manifests it ways, you know, in many many different ways. So. All right, man. Well, look, this is like, so we haven't done this before. So this is our first, you know, two part. It's almost like two pack. So two part, this is our two part, four part. I don't know what to call this, Murph. We're going to have to come up with a name for the new kind of thing, you know, four part, two parter.
We'll call this Rick Brambo setting the standard for guests on Game of Crimes. How about that?
What do you mean they have to pull down their shorts and crap on a rock and get their nuts stuck to it?
how about something simple and elegant, like Frozen No-No Parts, the DEA Alaska story? I don't know.
I've already started writing down a couple things. I mean, we're talking about, just in your short time, you survived two shootings, a grizzly bear, an assassination attempt, and a serial killer. I think the headline writes itself.
And a moose.
Oh, yeah. Hey, before we go, Give us one more moose call. Come on, call the boys in the yard. Come on.
Ah, boy. All right. This is like a Vegas act. It's like a really bad Vegas act. I got two shows a day. All right, here we go. This is what it's come to in my life, doing cow calls on a podcast. I used to be a man among men, you know, fast roping out of helicopters and in the dark of night on speedboats in the Caribbean, and now I'm doing cow calls on a podcast.
Now it's frozen nuts and cow calls. Yeah.
That's it. There you go. I think you got it.
When Javier and I go out and do a speaking event, we tell people we used to carry guns, now we carry Sharpies.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Well, look, man, this has been fun. And dude, I'm glad you're, I mean, you seem a little lonely up there, but I assume, you know, you're not batching it again. I mean, it's going to be this, your long, you know, not long national nightmare is going to be over here pretty soon. You're going to have company and you won't need to do cow calls, you know, to get somebody to come by and visit you, right?
That's right.
All right.
This has been a lot of fun, Rick. Thank you very much for coming on the show, brother.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Really has.
All right. Well, this has been fun. Don't you guys go anywhere. Everybody else, stay tuned for the final debrief. I wasn't joking. Did you see the Bears? The Bears. Did you see the claws on that? It gives a whole new meaning. Next time I go order a bear claw from Dunkin' Donuts, I'm going to say, you want to see a bear claw? Let me show you a bear claw.
You know, as many times as I've seen the picture, I just pulled up our website now to look at it again. It's fascinating. I mean, the claws on that thing, we asked him, and I don't think we ever got an answer, but they've got to be several inches long.
I thought he said it was about 8 inches.
Is that what he said?
I missed that part. Yeah.
I may have dozed off during that part, but. What a storied career Rick has had. You know, he's proven himself to be a patriot of the United States. He almost had to sacrifice his life and came close to sacrificing his wife's life to do his job over in St. Croix. Brother, you are a true patriot, a true hero. I can't tell you how honored we were to have had you on here and that you gave us all the extra time. I've got a feeling that if we asked you for another 6 hours, you'd have done it.
Well, he's invited us up to Alaska, and I put pictures of his boat up there. He said, come up to Alaska. We'll go out on my boat.
That boat is sweet. I mean, that is sweet.
Well, I'll tell you, the other thing, too, is how weird is it? And this is the cop thing, right? The hairs on the back of your neck. He walks by what is later found out to be the serial killer, Israel mm-hmm. Keyes.
Yeah.
And just, he knows it. It's just that sixth sense you walk by, and it's like, and he said he did. He walked with his back towards the guy. And fortunately, when he was out jogging, he was armed. But there was, as they found out later, this guy was scanning and trolling jogging trails and places looking for women to kidnap.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing about Rick here, he writes articles for Firearms News. So if you're into that kind of thing, you know, keep an eye out for his articles because now you've heard from the man. You know his background.
And when you see this picture of the grizzly, you'll know he's a good shot. And one with the set of... How big of a set of balls do you have to have?
Oh, I'd still be cleaning my pants out.
No, Murph. The bear would be picking his teeth with what was left of your pants.
Gosh.
Picking those out. Give me a toothpick. I think I still got a little Murph in here.
Brother Rick, thank you, man. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you guys. And thank you guys. Hey, we appreciate it. So if you like what you heard, if you like this episode, head on over to Apple, Spotify, give us those 5 stars, leave your comments. We take all comments with stride. We try mm-hmm. to progress and do better based upon the comments and the suggestions you give us. So go do that. It's very important. We get some feedback. We find out from you guys how you think we're doing. So head on over to gameofcrimespodcast.com, see the pictures we're telling you about, and tell me that you wouldn't crap your pants if that thing just even got within a mile of you. You know, and follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook, and the Instagram. But where you got to be is patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Yeah, you know, we've got a ton of content on there. It's so much fun. You just got to join it. And don't forget to go visit Game of Crimes fans. Sandy Salvato, our favorite mafia queen, rules with the iron fist and the velvet glove. Just head on over there. That's our private group where we have better discussions and funny stuff. We share a lot of pictures there. So head on over there. But again, no matter what you do, just tune in again next week because we're going to do the same thing again. We've got an episode coming up, 4-parter. You're going to want to hear this because this gets into something we've been asked a lot before about mental illness, or not mental health, I should say, mm-hmm. Dealing with officer wellness, How do you survive these shootings? You know, how do you deal with the trauma, the PTSD? And we've got somebody who's been through it, got a hell of a story to tell, and we'll be bringing that to you that next week. But in the meantime, we want to thank you guys once again for playing the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Don't Get Me Near a Bear Like That Again Game of Crimes.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.